Good morning, Reality Church. 10:45 service. How are you feeling today? You doing all right? Woo! Man, you guys are killing it. I'm going to tell the 9 o'clock service about this. So, welcome. I am Lance Birch. I'm one of the pastors here at Reality Church, and we're on week 3 of a series that we're calling Atypical Christmas, because we're taking the Christmas story, and we're looking at really familiar icons, familiar themes, and we're saying, what if there's something there that we haven't seen? What if there's something behind that that we need to take another angle on? And so this is a time of year when I know that you guys are got a lot of stuff going on, and I want to thank you for being here. If you're a first-time guest, we're so glad you made the choice to be here today. I also want to thank you guys for your generosity. This has been a phenomenal year when it comes to generosity, and you guys have met so many needs in our community and around the world because of your gifts. I do want to tell you that we're about $10,000 away from limitless, which means that the people who see polls right now will one day see words, you know, that they can sing and maybe even see me a little bit. So that would be great. That's going to happen at the end of the year. If that's something that you want to give to, mark limitless, and we will see that happen at the beginning of the year. This is a time of year when we're filled with distractions, okay? Christmas distractions. That happens every single year. Now, in my family, we try to work against that, right? So we do this thing at my house called the Jesse tree. I don't know whether you've heard this. It's sort of an Advent tree where you have this tree. It's got all these branches, and there's these Bible stories that go with specific ornaments. You read the Bible story, you talk about it, and it goes all the way from Genesis all the way to the manger. So starts December 1st, and all the way till December 25th. So that's what my family does at Christmas. That's what we do. I don't know what your family does, but we do the Bible in my house. So just about every year we forget to do the Jesse tree, all right? Just about every single year, like we start on December 1st and we do this whole thing. We meet, you know, we got hot chocolate and we open up the Bible and I read, you know, and we talk about Genesis and how the very first sin and the garden and the promise of the Messiah. And then on December 2nd, I don't know, we just forget watching TV or something, I don't know. So then like 2 or 3 days later, we go, have we done the Jesse tree? It seems like the Jesse tree is a little bare. And then we like do 2 or 3 or 4 of them rapidly. And I'm like rushing through and like, okay, skip that. Just hang the ornament, you know? Then like December 24th, you know, like Christmas Eve, it's like, we haven't done any of them. So we do like 10 in a row. And why is that? Then this year has kind of been that way. I left town. And so life sort of vies for your attention and the calendar just keeps on rolling. And it seems to me this time of year, no matter how many times I say, you know what, really drink it in this year, Lance. Experience the season. Think about Jesus. Think about the great gift that he gave us. Still, it just rolls too fast for me. And before I know it, it's Christmas Eve. I don't know what your life is like, but it seems like to me that this is that special time of year. A time of year that we struggled to get the tree up the stairs to the living room in that brilliant bag that was going to be so much better than the box. This is the kind of year, the time of year that we break that keepsake ornament and break out the hot glue gun again. We clean out the gutters so we can put our lights up so we're not the only house on the block that's dark. Or you can be lazy and just plant a laser in your front yard. But be careful and don't point it at the planes passing by overhead. The kids have road games, early practices, that huge history project, and finals to study for. We have 5 different Christmas parties to show up for so that no one gets offended by our party pics on Facebook when we didn't attend theirs. Don't forget your son's extra holiday hours at his part-time job. When is that boy going to get a license? Don't forget to write down the dates and times of the performances and the rehearsals for the programs at school, church, and the senior center where they actually want you to show up dressed as Buddy the Elf. In tights. Speaking of elves, you've got that naughty elf on the shelf causing chaos in your house, and you really hope that yours is as cool as all the ones you're seeing on Instagram and Pinterest. And then there's the shopping. Your son wants a new gaming system that is both virtual reality and can read his mind. Your daughter wants a doll that you're going to have to make payments on. And your sister has messaged you 3 times asking what you want for Christmas and why haven't you set up an Amazon wish list so far? Your spouse thinks maybe the two of you should just purchase a water filtration system for each other for Christmas, or maybe just chuck it all and go to the Bahamas. And then there's that Secret Santa thing at work. Who came up with Secret Santa? The school sent home a note saying that half the kids have strep and that you're pretty sure there was something wrong with that last piece of fruitcake you just ate. And your daughter is looking and sounding so stuffy that she seems like Rudolph. Christmas is at your parents' house this year. And also at your spouse's brother's place down south. And also at your aunt's place on the lake. And if you drive through the night with your radar detector on high sensitivity and the weather holds out and your kids sleep in the car, you just might make all three. You should make sure to stop in at the office party for at least a little bit. Also, your friends are in town, so could we set aside a night of the week so we could do a special Christmas just with them? Oh, wait, can we do it at your house? Your boss needs that project done before Christmas, even though he's going to be out of town till January. And on top of that, you're covering for your coworker who spends every Christmas in Hawaii, and none of your contractors are going to answer the phone after December 15th anyway. Oh, yeah. And don't forget to make that green bean dish you're so good at for Christmas dinner. And that apple cake dessert that all the kids like for that other Christmas dinner. And something gluten-free for Aunt Vivian because she's all wired up about that. And bring that backup ham in case that thing happens with your mom's oven again. Also, there's cookies and carols at the church on Saturday afternoon. They're asking for everyone to bring a couple of dozen. And don't forget, Jesus is the reason for the season. I forgot. I just bowed, and this is going to be the one online. I really apologize for that, for those of you watching online. But there is hope. There is hope, and there's a way for you and I to point to something different than all the distractions. There's a way for us to point to something that actually focuses us. And we see a lot of lights in Christmas, and they're on homes. And basically that means basically that home believes that there was a Savior born 2,000 years ago. We can be the pathway to hope. In week one, we talked about how there's a messenger of hope, the angels, and how they were giving the message of hope. And that now we have the Holy Spirit. And last week, we talked about the reason for hope. That the virgin birth is actually even more important than maybe we thought. It's actually the gospel in a nutshell. And this week we're going to talk about the star and how the star can give you and me a pathway to hope and also teach us what we're supposed to be in this culture of distractions. See, God is always interested and so invested in bringing people who are far from him to be near. He's so invested in that he's willing to go to astronomical lengths to do it. People who, just like us, can find themselves far away from what Christmas is really all about. God is invested in letting people far from him in on what Christmas is all about. And that's the story we're going to take a look at. Josh read it a few minutes ago, but I want us to take a look at it and maybe see whether there's something we've been missing so that we could have an atypical Christmas. It's in Matthew chapter 2, so pull that up on your device or open up your Bibles, or it's going to be on the screen here. But let's talk about just how invested God is in bringing people far from him near. So here's the story. Jesus was born in Bethlehem, a little town about 6 miles southeast of Jerusalem, okay? In Judea during the reign of King Herod. King Herod, when you read King Herod, think bad guy, okay? Think Kylo Ren, whatever it takes, but think bad guy. About that time, some wise men from the eastern lands. Now, that's interesting. Who are these guys from the eastern lands? These guys, the Greek word there is magoi, or we get the word or magi. And magi, basically, we get the word magician from that. And these guys were astrologers or astronomers. The important thing to note here is that Matthew, while writing this story, is saying, here's the deal. Jesus was born in Bethlehem, in Judea, at the time of Herod. A lot of people, when they talk about Jesus in history class or in culture, they talk about the myth of Jesus or the oral history that got passed down. And it was kind of a mythological story, and it's not really true, and it's just like all of the other, you know, the Greek gods and all of that. This is not written as myth. Basically, Matthew is writing in the time period of people who could check this out. So he says, here's the place, here's the time, here's who the king was. So he's saying, this is historicity right here. This is historical events that you can go and check out when Matthew wrote this. So about that time, some magi from the eastern lands, we don't know where they were really from, but you guys know the tradition, right? The common legend about these wise men is that there were three of them named Balthazar, Gaspar, and some guy who, Melchior. They didn't have baby naming websites at the time, so these guys really missed out. Or maybe they did, and they just were like, really weird. These guys showed up, and every graphic that you ever see of the Magi has them on camels. But we know that they didn't ride camels. They rode really big, strong horses. And they were, the tradition, though, says that they were from three different nations, Babylonia, Persia, and India. And one early writer called them three kings. But there's nothing in the Bible that says they were kings. They were simply magi. They were wise men. They were astrologers or astronomers. And the phrase wise men in Matthew 2, 1, and 7 is magi. And it applies to a special group of men, a class of scholars called magi, from where we get magic and magician. And they may originally have come from a tribe in Media and may even have become later a part of the governing party in Persia. And they were especially interested in astronomy and prophecy and wisdom. And that it gave them a talent so that they were usually attached to kings. Kings would call them in. They were consultants. They were people who would be brought in when the king was confused about something or needed to know whether something was going to happen or what was going to happen. These magi were consulted, and they would check their charts, and they would check the stars, and then they would deliver to the king the news, basically. They were eventually some sort of priestly class, and they hung out with the kings. They were attached to royal courts in Babylonia, Persia, even Arabia, and as far away as India, as consultants, advisors, nobles to the king. Well, they arrived in Jerusalem. Now, the reason they arrived in Jerusalem is because Jerusalem's the seat of power. You know, they had hopped on their horses a few months back. We don't exactly know how long ago they've been traveling. But they were traveling because they thought something big has happened in Israel. And where would they go? They would go to the logical seat of power. And they would start asking in the capital city a big question. In fact, this question caused quite a stir. And here was the question: where is the newborn king of the Jews? Doesn't it make sense that if a newborn king was born, that newborn king would be born in the capital, probably the son of the current king? So they were saying, where's the newborn king? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him. What was this star? Some sort of astronomical event. Something happened. The Bible, all throughout the scripture, even in the Psalms, says that God uses nature to proclaim who he is. He used the burning bush. He uses, you know, when you go to the Grand Canyon, there's the grandeur of it. Romans says that when we see creation, we're reminded of the Creator, unless we're kind of blinded. And Psalm 19, 1 through 2 says, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship. Day after day, if you look, they continue to speak. Night after night, they make him known. Well, these wise men in the east, we don't know where, looked up at the sky, and something new happened. Something they hadn't seen before. But here's the interesting part. Something they were watching for. Something they were waiting for. And that actually begs the question, or it actually creates the question, why were they waiting for something? How did they know this was going to happen? So they were looking for the star. They saw his star. They connected this star to the newborn king. And that's an interesting question. Why would they do that? But more than that, we need to realize that God is willing to move on an astronomical scale to draw those people who are far from him to come close. And they were there because they believed that that star was connected to a new king. And they came to worship him. Now, here's what's interesting about these magi. Their story goes back about 1,300 years. We actually think we know who the first magi was, or the founder of this group of magi that were looking for the Messiah. They were looking for this new king. And it goes back to the book of Numbers. There's a man by the name of Balaam. Now, Balaam's dad was named Beor, and he was a prophet, and he was a pagan. He was an astrologer. He was not of the Jewish faith, and yet he was used by God. Here's the story. there's a king of the Moabites named Balak, and he has heard about all these Israelites moving into the land, and they're basically kicking tail and taking names, all right? They're crushing everybody. And so Balak sends some messengers to Balaam. These are all B names. And he says, I want you to come out here, and I want you to prophesy against Israel. I want you to listen to God and then prophesy that they're going to get crushed by us, the Moabites. And Balaam says, I'm not going to go there because the word that I've got is they're going to crush you. And I can only say what God says. And Balak keeps on asking. And finally, God says, no, go, Balaam. Go out there and tell them what I told you. And there's a funny little episode that happens on the way. Maybe you've heard of it. His donkey stops in the middle of the road. And he's like, why are you stopping? And then he starts to beat the donkey. Go, go, go. And the donkey says, literally out loud, what have I ever done to you? Basically, you know, I've been your donkey for a long time now. What did I do wrong? And then God opens his eyes and there's this angel in the middle of the road with a flaming sword. And Balaam says, oh, sorry, donkey. And then they go on. And he gets to Balak and he eventually says to him, look, you're not going to win this battle. This is not going to go well for you. And in Numbers 24, 17, he makes a prophecy that we really need to pay attention to. I see him, he's talking about this distant person that's going to come on the scene. I see him in 24, 17, he says, I see him, but not here and now. I perceive him, but far and in the distant future. Get this, a star will rise from Jacob. A scepter will emerge from Israel, and it will crush the heads of Moab's people, cracking the skulls of the people of Sheth. Cracking skulls, that's actually biblical. That goes way back to the Old Testament. Cracking skulls is a biblical way to put things. So Balaam is prophesying two things. He says there's going to be a star, and that star is going to signify a new king. The scepter means authority, and it says, basically, he's saying there's going to be a new king that will emerge, and it's going to come from Israel, and the star is going to be the sign. Now, 1,300 years later, Balaam's disciples, the disciples of his disciples of his disciples, are watching and waiting. Why else would people in the East have any connection with Israel at all? Now, we don't know this to be true, but this is a really good indicator that this is what might have happened, that Balaam was the founder of these magi, and they were actually waiting for the star. They ride into town on their big horses, and remember, there weren't just three of them. If they were traveling around and they were really powerful consultants of the kings, there were probably dozens of magi, or at least a dozen or more magi, and they had their military escort for sure, because they wouldn't travel through these lands without a military escort, and all sorts of servants and people, their entourage basically, their squad, if you will, just traveled with them all the way. And King Herod, when he saw that whole big thing, he was deeply disturbed. It wasn't just like a few people came up and said, where's the king? No, there was an entourage. And he thought, this must be true. Something big is going on here that I'm not privy to. And everyone in Jerusalem was kind of up in arms about it. Herod was thinking he was going to lose power. These other people were seeing this powerful nation come in, and it had to be unsettling. And actually, the nations are not, the whole world wasn't controlled by Rome. There were other powerful empires that could move in. So he called a meeting of the leading priests and the teachers of the religious law, and he asked them, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? See, Herod had obviously skipped life group a couple of times, and he had no clue what was going on. He wasn't studying his Bible. And they said, look, in Bethlehem in Judea. For they said, this is what the prophet wrote. They're referencing the prophet Micah. And you, O Bethlehem in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah. For a ruler will come from you who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. They're talking about the Messiah. Isn't it weird how we can miss what is so plainly written in Scripture? This was so clear. And yet the kings and all the people weren't waiting on it. Who was waiting on it? Oh, just a group of pagans out in the East who were looking at the sky. And God was moving astronomically to draw those people who were far from him to come close. And we just miss it. That's why when somebody asks me, how do you think Jesus is going to come back? And what's your the term for that is eschatology. Are you a premillennialist? Are you a postmillennialist? Are you an amillennialist? And I go, man, I follow the word. I know Jesus is coming back. But remember this, they had 2,000 years of prophecy for Jesus' first coming, and they missed it. And so I may just be a little arrogant if I think I'm going to get it. You know, so I don't know exactly how he's going to come back. They had all of this prophecy, and yet they missed it. We can miss what's plainly written, especially if we are distracted. So Herod, he hasn't talked to the Magi yet. He calls a meeting with them. He calls a private meeting with the Magi, and he learns from them the time when the star first appeared. Now, when they talked, we think, based on Herod's action, that they told him the star appeared about 2 years ago. The reason we think that, even though they don't say it, is that Herod actually set about to kill all the infants born in Bethlehem, 2 years old and younger. And he did that. And a lot of historians say, well, that's not recorded in history. You have to remember that Bethlehem was a very small village. And this was a raiding party that went in there and killed, I don't know, maybe a dozen or so, toddlers down to infants. And so we believe that they told him it showed up in the sky about 2 years ago. And they were representing, these magi were representing all of these powerful nations, and this had to disturb Herod to the level that he decided to take this action of killing these toddlers all the way down to infants. So he told them, after learning about this, he says, hey, here's the deal. He had a plan. His first plan was not to kill everybody. His first plan was this: go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child. And when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go and worship him too. That was not his plan. He was obviously going to kill the threat to his own power. So they went. Bethlehem is about 6 miles southeast of Jerusalem. And they went and they found him. After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east guided them to Bethlehem. It went ahead of them and stopped over the place where the child was. Now, does any of this strike you as odd? I mean, when you're walking around, do stars guide you? Do you walk around and say, oh, where's that star going? I'm going to follow that star, and then it rests over somebody's, over a city, and you say, I guess we're going to camp here. That seems a little strange. And so when people start looking at this whole issue of what is the star, there's a lot of different opinions. I've been researching this for a while now, and there's a few options, a lot of good theologians disagree on this stuff. But whatever it was astronomical, and these guys saw it. And then the Bible seems to say that they didn't see it for a while, and then they saw it again. But anyway, the theologians will say that it's alignment of planets. You know, sometimes, do you guys remember when Jupiter and Venus got really close to each other and it got really bright? Some people say that that is kind of what happened. That happened on June 30th of this year. And that's kind of what happened, and that was the Bethlehem star. Some people say that it's alignment of planets and a star. Some people think it's a comet, you know, with a tail as big as a kite. And it just kind of led them all the way to Bethlehem, and it rested on the horizon right where Bethlehem was. Some people say a nova or a supernova. Honestly, there's no agreement on this. There's so much disagreement on what this star was. It's like these guys are battling about the star. It's like some sort of star battle or a war about this celestial ball of fire or some sort of stellar conflict or a cosmic fight. I wish I could put it more succinctly, but that's about it. Whatever the star was, it led them right to the place where Jesus was being born. And then they, on their way there to Bethlehem, the Bible seems to indicate, they see the star. And when they saw the star, they were filled with joy. When they saw this pathway to hope, this way for them to finally fulfill all of this planning and all of this packing and all of this logistics of moving this crowd of people miles and miles and miles. Why? Well, I think I have a hint at why. 1,300 years ago, Balaam said, there's going to be a new king and he's going to crush everybody. And so they say, okay, all right, great. Well, let's get on his team then. If he's going to be born 13 years, let's watch for his star. And when he's born, let's go make nice. And so they did all of this packing and all this planning. And when they saw the star, they thought, oh, it's all coming true. That prophecy that we had listened to. And actually, guys, this isn't about watching the stars and getting the truth about God from the stars. This is actually about God changing the heavens to line up with his prophecy, his truth, and his word. Because that's where we find truth. We find truth, and then everything else bows to the truth that we find in the Bible. So that's why they were so happy. They were filled with joy. And then they entered the house and saw the child with his mother. This is interesting because most nativity scenes will have the guys on camels, which every image you find has them on camels, but they rode horses. But they didn't show up at the stable. Nowhere in the Bible does it say that the wise men or the magi showed up at the stable and found the baby wrapped in swaddling cloths. No, they entered the house and they saw the child. He may have been 1 year old or 2 years old or whatever, but he was there with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and they worshiped him. They opened their treasure chest and they gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They were making sacrifices to the one who they knew was going to be king. In this little town, think about how much faith that took. This little town southeast of Jerusalem, they bowed down and they worshiped him. And then they got up and they left. I don't know how long they stayed or what happened, but you know, I don't think it was anticlimactic for them because the star had led them right to that place. When it's time to leave, they return to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod. God was so interested in these guys that even though they were pagan, even though they really didn't understand what was going on, they knew what they were looking for, and they knew that they were going to travel and find this king. And so God rescued them, basically, and he rescued Jesus by saying, go home by another route. So we don't know a lot. As you look at this Christmas story, we don't have a lot of blanks filled in, and that's kind of cool because I think sometimes when we come to church, we try to figure out and diagram and figure everything out about God, but he's sort of a mystery. We'll never have everything figured out about God. Give us a billion years in heaven, and we won't know everything about God. We won't know everything he does. He will still be in some ways a mystery to us because that's who he is. So we don't know, for instance, what the star was. We don't know where the wise men were from. We don't exactly even know what they were. We know that they were sort of astrologers. We know we've got some hints. We don't know how many of them there were. But here's one thing we do know. God wanted some people who were far from him to be close. And he was so invested in those people who were far from him that he changed the heavens to draw them in. That might be your story. If you tell your story about how when you were far from God, all the things that had to happen for you to be drawn near, and some of them maybe weren't good. I don't know all the stories of the caravan. I don't know everything that happened on the journey, but I bet you some bad things happened. But along that way, they were always led and they were always being drawn. And maybe that's your story. God has been drawing you. Maybe this is your first time back in church for a long time. And God is so invested in drawing someone far from him near that he'll change the heavens to do it. God is willing to move on an astronomical scale to draw those far from him near. God, when there's people far from him, is willing to move on an astronomical scale to draw those people in. He's willing to change the heavens, to move heaven and earth. More than that, he was willing to step out of eternity, wrap himself in skin as a sacrifice to pay the penalty for our sin that we could never pay. He did that for us. He's willing to move on an astronomical scale to draw those far from him near. What are you willing to do? When we look out there at the world this Christmas, and we're so tempted to make it about us, and there are so many people this Christmas who have no clue that there's a God that loves them, that there was a baby born that grew up to rescue them. God was willing to move on an astronomical scale. What are you willing to do? We are to be the light of the world, aren't we? And when the wise men saw the star, they were filled with joy. Are people filled with joy when we say, come to church with me? Are they like, yes? Don't laugh at that. This is what I do. No, they are excited. But maybe they have this weird idea of what church is or what it can be or who Jesus is or who God is. What about when they see you? Are they filled with joy? Because Jesus said that you are the light of the world. That's what Jesus said. He said, you're the light of the world, like a city on a hill that can't be hidden. When I grew up, I lived in Midland, Texas, and the world is flat there. And when we would travel, we would pass Sweetwater and we would pass all these cities. But every time we drove down the road, you could see every city, no matter how far away they were, just this clump of lights over there. And if you're a traveler and you're low on resources like fuel or food or rest, there's fuel, there's food, there's lodging, there's gas. And you take the next exit because you can see that city over there. And you're glad for it. The church is supposed to be like that. You're supposed to be, we are supposed to be, I'm supposed to be the light of the world. And when people see us, they ought to, in their minds, they ought to go, not be saying, oh no, they ought to be saying, yes, yes. And so, if God's willing to move on an astronomical scale, we need to ask ourselves that question, do we bring that sort of reaction that the star brought to the Magi? We're the light of the world. That's our job. Who do you know that is just one invitation away from life change? Who do you know? Are you willing to do anything about it? Can you imagine this place on Christmas Eve, filled to the brim for four services? Can you imagine the life change that can come from that? Do you know that we have people attending Reality Church right now whose first service was a Christmas Eve service and someone here invited them? That they could come and they could hear, maybe for the first time, what Christmas is all about. And yes, cool things are going to happen, or at least cool things from our point of view. We think we're going to do some cool stuff. But people are going to hear the gospel. I want you to do something pretty specific, okay? I want all of us to invite four. Now, we've got these cards out there. You can't see them, but they're back there. And on it, it says Christmas Eve at Reality Church. And on the back, it's got our service times and our address, which is great. But if you want, you can also pick them up because sometimes they don't come. Sometimes you're out there in the lobby saying that they promised they'd come. And that's sometimes the saddest thing to people, see people out there who invited people. Go and pick them up, trick them. Say you're taking them out for Chick-fil-A. All of these stacks are stacks of four out there. And invite four. And if you're a kid in the room, if you're a kid and you say, this is not for me, if you're here, this is for you. You know people who are far from God. God was willing to move on an astronomical scale. Are you willing to hand them a card and say, come to this, it might be cool? That's fine. Get it in their hand and say, I just want to invite you. So many people are one invitation away from life change. Take a few, but I'm looking for everyone here to invite four. I can see it. I can see 1,200 people here hearing the gospel. I can see 1,200 people here realigning, recalibrating their mind for Christmas. I can see them joining this body of believers and marriages saved and kids raised in a way that they weren't going to be raised and people making an impact on this community that wouldn't have happened. I see all that. And I want you to see that. And I want when people think of Reality Church to be filled with joy for us to be what God called us to be, the light of the world. God was willing to move on an astronomical scale. What are we willing to do?